It is Wednesday, December 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a Democrat wins election to the U.S. Senate from Alabama.
Moore was already a weak candidate, comparatively speaking. Weaker than you might expect a sort of a generic Republican to be in Alabama.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson hopes diplomacy can counter North Korea's nuclear threat. And singer Ed Sheeran joins forces with another pop music powerhouse for a remix that's topping the charts. It's all ahead. Democrat Doug Jones won the special election to fill a vacant U.S. Senate seat representing the southern state of Alabama. The result delivered what many see as a stunning setback to the Republican Party and a stinging rebuke to President Donald Trump, who urgently endorsed embattled Republican candidate Roy Moore despite a chorus of sexual misconduct allegations. After a contentious campaign, voters backed Jones over Moore by a margin of 49.9% to 48.4%. The result means that in January, when Jones is sworn in, the Republican majority in the 100-seat Senate will shrink to 51 to 49 and make it tougher for President Trump to enact his agenda. Jeffrey Skelly is a political analyst at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. I asked him the reasons for Moore's defeat.
Well, I think you have to start with the candidate himself to some extent. I mean, look, even before the allegations of sexual impropriety or harassment or molestation even of girls under the age of 18, Moore was already a weak candidate, comparatively speaking, weaker than you might expect a sort of a generic Republican to be in Alabama. And we know that because in the 2012 election cycle, he ran for his, what ended up being his second service time on the Alabama Supreme Court as Chief Justice. He ran in the election in 2012. And he ran way behind Mitt Romney, who was at the top of the ticket as a Republican presidential nominee. And Moore only won by 4 points, while Romney was easily winning a little over 60% of the vote in Alabama. And so we knew that Moore was a weak candidate to start with. So I think if you combine the fact that Moore was a particularly weak candidate, even weaker than he seemed to be before the allegations made against him, and you add that to the overall environment, pretty Democratic friendly. If you look at where President Trump's approval is, it's slightly above water in Alabama, but overall the electorate actually had an approval rating that was even. So if you take the fact that the overall environment was Democratic leaning and you throw in the fact that Jones, the Democratic nominee, also had a lot more money because most national Republican groups weren't willing to spend on Moore's behalf and he wasn't able to raise that much. You add all these factors into, a big mixer, and you ended up with a narrow Jones win, remarkably.
Well, and also Republican Senator Richard Shelby said he was not going to vote for Moore, even though they were both Republicans. And also African-American voters came out very, very strongly for Jones.
Certainly, yeah. So Richard Shelby's reaction to Moore's candidacy following the allegations made against him is sort of indicative, I think, of what happened in the election in the sense that you saw Republicans clearly not turning out at the same rate as Democrats, and you saw a fairly large number of write-in votes. Nearly 2% of the vote was write-ins, and basically the margin, it's unofficial at this point, but the margin in the race and the number of write-in votes was about the same. So, I think you could talk about write-ins. Most of those write-ins were probably Republicans who just didn't want to vote for Moore because he was so toxic. So I think that that's important. And then at the end of the day, black turnout was critical for Doug Jones. Alabama is probably one of the most racially polarized states in the country in terms of voting. Usually, Democrats are going to win at least 90% of the African-American vote, but they struggled to do better than 20% of the white vote, and the exit poll suggested that Jones got, about 30% of the white vote. And that combined with very strong African-American turnout, especially compared to rural white turnout, which obviously is much more Republican-leaning, that ended up adding up to about a 1.5-point margin for Jones.
What will the significance of this race, of this election, have for President Trump?
Well, obviously, Donald Trump backed not one but two losers in Alabama. He backed Luther Strange in the Republican primary, perhaps, you know, on behalf of Mitch McConnell, even though Roy Moore's sort of anti-establishment nature and you know, much of the way he carries himself as a candidate was somewhat reflective of the president in 2016 during that campaign. The fact that Trump backed Strange and Strange lost, and then, you know, at the very end of this general election campaign, Trump came out very strongly for Roy Moore, did a rally in nearby Pensacola, Florida, which also happens to be basically in the TV market in one of the more conservative parts of Alabama in the southeastern corner of that state. Trump came out and pushed on behalf of Moore, and apparently there were robocalls to Republicans in Alabama with Trump telling them to go out to vote for Moore, and it wasn't enough. And I think that just suggests that Donald Trump isn't able to greatly swing things when he's not on the ballot. And you know what? This is a familiar problem. You know, if we recall Barack Obama not being able to do much for Democrats when he wasn't on the ballot, and Donald Trump may not be able to exert that much influence when he's not on the ballot and when he's just suggesting or endorsing candidates, that just may be insufficient to really impact things.
Political analyst Jeffrey Skelly of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, I'm sure this is getting a lot of reaction on social media.
It's the past 24 hours has been focused on Alabama. And as we were talking about just before we came on air, it's very strange to see that focus on a state that's reliably Republican. But here we are today talking about it. We talked about yesterday, hashtag Dear Alabama, people talking about to the voters of Alabama, trying to address them directly and influence their vote. Well, today we have hashtag Thank You Alabama. And those were the words tweeted out last night by Doug Jones as he was declared the winner in that contentious Senate election. People talking about surprised that this happened, but even more surprised that Roy Moore, given the allegations against him, was so competitive. And so you have a lot of people talking about that. I think there's a lot of relief among some Republicans. I've seen some very conservative Republicans who said they were not supporting Roy Moore because of these allegations. And now the Senate doesn't have to worry about what to do with him if he was elected, because he has not been. And a lot of people noting the power of women in this election, not just the women coming forward to talk about the allegations against Moore, but African-American women influencing the vote. African-Americans in particular in Alabama really played a huge role in getting this election for Doug Jones, and hashtag Black Women is trending as people are thanking Black women in Alabama for taking a stand and speaking out and voting in very large numbers for Doug Jones. So we're still seeing a lot of talk about that, including from the president himself. A very unusual tweet last night from President Trump. Usually he's very fiery on Twitter, but he writes last night, "Congratulations to Doug Jones on a hard-fought victory. The write-in votes played a very big factor, but a win is a win. The people of Alabama are great, and the Republicans will have another shot at the seat in a very short period of time. It never ends." So a lot of people very surprised by President Trump's response, perhaps a bit humbled after he first backed sitting Senator Luther Strange, who lost in the primary, and then backed Roy Moore, who lost in this general election. Trump then went on to tweet and say that Roy Moore was never going to win anyway, and kind of cover his tracks a little bit. But he said just today, he said that the Republicans need to put up great candidates in both the House and Senate to run for office. So a bit more measured in his assessment of this election. The other big trending story today here in the U.S., the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2018 inductees have been announced. Bon Jovi, The Cars, Dire Straits, The Moody Blues, Nina Simone, and sister Rosetta Tharpe, who is a gospel singer. Simone and Tharpe being inducted for their influence on what would become rock and roll as early pioneers of music and of blues. The other bands, needless to say, very hugely popular in the U.S. and around the world. Bon Jovi is trending because he has quite a large fan base, so they are very excited about this, and we'll have to look forward to the induction ceremony in Cleveland, Ohio, where the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is located. That'll be in April of 2018.
Look forward to that.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Saudi-led airstrikes kill 30 people in Yemen's capital. Two Reuters reporters are jailed in Myanmar on suspicion of possessing secret documents. Amnesty International accuses the European Union of being complicit in Libyan migrant abuse. And China observes the 80th anniversary of the Nanjing massacre. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Juno spacecraft has provided scientists with new information on Jupiter's iconic Great Red Spot. The Great Red Spot is actually an ongoing high-pressure storm raging in its atmosphere with winds that can reach speeds of 430 to 680 kilometers per hour. After analyzing data from Juno's first pass over Jupiter in July 2017, the mission's investigators found that the depth of the giant red spot penetrates a good distance beneath the planet's clouds. According to the mission's principal investigator, Scott Bolton, data provided by the space probe shows that the giant storm has routes that pass through about 300 kilometers of Jupiter's atmosphere. NASA also says that Juno has detected a new radiation zone above the planet's atmosphere near its equator. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about Ed Sheeran's new remix of his song, Perfect. UN Undersecretary for Political Affairs Jeffrey Feltman told reporters in New York late Tuesday his talks in Pyongyang last week with senior North Korean officials found common ground on the need to prevent war over its nuclear and missile programs, but little else.
North Korean interlocutors agreed it was important to prevent war. How we do that was the topic of 15-plus hours of discussions. The people who we met listened carefully to our arguments. They explored our thinking. They asked questions. They argued with us. But ultimately, they have to take what we said and talk about it internally, talk about it with their leadership. That's why I'm reluctant to say now what is the impact of our visit, because they need time to digest and consider how they will respond to our message.
Feltman said he believes the door to a diplomatic solution has been left ajar and hopes the door to a diplomatic solution will be open wide. He told them the international community is committed to a peaceful solution, but is united in opposition to North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons. His views came the same day that U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson offered an apparent change in policy of holding talks with the North without precondition.
We've said from the diplomatic side, we're ready to talk anytime North Korea would like to talk. And we're ready to have the first meeting without precondition. Let's just meet. We can talk about the weather if you want. We can talk about whether it's going to be a square table or a round table if that's what you're excited about. But can we at least sit down and see each other face to face? And then we can begin to lay out a map, a roadmap, of what we might be willing to work towards. It's not realistic to say we're only going to talk if you come to the table ready to give up your program. They have too much invested in it. And the president is very realistic about that as well. And so it's really about how do you even begin the process of engagement, because we're dealing with a new leader in North Korea that no one's ever engaged with.
Tillerson said the U.S. will not tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea, but he said such talks could be held after a period of quiet without nuclear or missile testing. It's unclear whether President Donald Trump, who has said talking with North Korea would be a waste of time, gave his approval to the speech to the Atlantic Council think tank. But Korea Society's Senior Director of Policy, Stephen Norfer, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty such a position is long overdue and a step forward in easing tensions.
For the United States to basically be in the position of saying that it's willing to come to the table and talk without those preconditions on North Korea means that negotiations much more likely. The prior situation, less so if it meant that they had to give that up as part of the precondition to come to the table. At this point, the United States is saying come and we'll talk from there.
He also mentioned that North Korea must show restraint. Quote, it's going to be tough to talk if in the middle of our talks, North Korea decides to test another device. So we continue to indicate to them that we need a period of quiet. You need to tell us you want to talk. North Korea has indicated it's not interested in talking, is it?
North Korea has held off on some of its testing up until the November 29th test. There had been almost a 75-day hiatus, and so Washington is signaling that it wants to see a similar type of pause in missile and nuclear activity to show seriousness to get to the table to negotiate.
Tillerson disclosed that the U.S. has been in discussions with China about how to secure North Korea's nuclear weapons in the event the government collapses.
Well, I think what he's trying to do is signal a few things. He's saying that there's muscle behind the diplomacy. So he reiterated that the U.S. has military capabilities. He noted that there is the opportunity to step up sanctions even further, and he noted that there's been this conversation with China over the nuclear stockpile issue and that the U.S., if it went forward, would then go back beyond the 38th parallel into South Korean territory to provide China some sort of security assurance. And all of that is designed to signal to North Korea that the U.S. is dealing with a portfolio of options, but it appears that negotiation now is certainly at the fore and a more realistic thing to be talking about today.
With regard to a dialogue without precondition, do you think President Trump backs that view?
I wouldn't be the person to answer that. Secretary Tillerson and President Trump are the only two people who know that answer, but one would assume with such a public address that Secretary Tillerson was going out and making an advance for negotiation, and one would assume that's coordinated with the White House.
Stephen Norfer, he's Senior Director of Policy for the Korea Society. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. Singer Ed Sheeran got a superstar to join him in a remix of his song Perfect, and the recording is topping the chart. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins me with the latest.
What makes this particular song so interesting? Ed contacted Beyoncé. He didn't expect her to say, yes, I'll do the song with you, but it's Ed's latest release, and we're going to listen to the Ed Sheeran-Beyoncé collaboration, which is called Perfect. Here on International Edition.
Well, I found a man stronger than anyone I know. He shares my dreams. I hope that someday we'll share our home. I found love to carry more than just my secrets, to carry love, to carry children of our own.
Yes, he had a pretty big hit, I think, earlier this year.
Though. Yeah, it was doing very well, and he had his fingers crossed for hoping for a number one song, but he needed the star power of a Beyoncé to pick it up to number one, which it is. It is the week's new number one song. It has just knocked Post Malone Rockstar off the top, which spent 8 weeks at number one. So Ed Sheeran has a new number one song, and it's called Perfect. Although Ed Sheeran didn't get the Grammy nominations everybody expected him to get. He only got two Grammy nominations. Jay-Z was the big Grammy nominee for the night with eight, but Ed is up for two. So Ed's album is Divide, and it was also revealed by Ed recently that he didn't get hit by a car while riding a bike. he was actually a little bit tipsy. He had gone to the pub and had a few too many and went down a hill on his bike. And it was widely reported that he was hit by a car. He said, no, no, it was just me being very careless. And he said, I promise to always wear a helmet when I bike in the future. But his arm and his hand have healed, and now he's back out on tour. He's going to continue to tour for the foreseeable future. The album is Divided. It's doing so well for him. He's had such a huge year. The most streamed song of the year, Shape of You, and his album Divide, the most streamed album of the entire year. So Ed is finishing strong, and a lot of people are just mystified. What is the allure or the attraction to Ed Sheeran? He's not particularly handsome. What is it about Ed Sheeran? Well, he writes great songs, and he's written for so many artists, and he's one of the most in-demand songwriters right now. Everybody wants to work with Ed Sheeran. Speaking of which, he said he sent an email to Beyonce, and it was not easy to find her because she changes her email address every week.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And so he sent it, and she did write back and say, I'll do it. And then he said he was even more impressed with her saying, how about if we do this, and how about if we try that? And so he loved it, and, you know, the song speaks for itself. It's now number one.
Yeah, and I believe I saw him just recently on the Internet, a picture of him performing with Taylor Swift.
Yeah, he's that, you know, very good friends with Taylor Swift, and he likes to run his music by Taylor, and she runs her music by him. It's just a matter of time before the two of them actually collaborate on a song. I can't figure out why that hasn't happened yet, but they are best friends. And she has nothing but love for him, and he in kind has nothing but love for her. So, yeah, they do hang out. They were at the Jingle Ball concert together. That's probably where you saw them on the Internet. They both performed in New York City. By the way, speaking of the Jingle Ball, here's a shameless plug for my show, Border Crossings. I was at the D.C. Jingle Ball this week, and I caught up with Camila Cabello, and she's got a new song out as well. And maybe we'll do that on next week's International Edition. And I also spoke with Julia Michaels, who's nominated for several Grammys. And it's interesting because she put out her first CD in 2010. She's got her third CD out now called Nervous System. And she's in the Best New Artist category.
Wow.
Even though she's been doing this for about 6 years. She was lovely to talk to. And I've also got an interview with a boy band called Why Don't We? That's the name of the group. Why Don't We? And so you'll hear those interviews coming up on Border Crossings.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Baby, I'm dancing in the dark.
All right. That's Ed Sheeran with Beyonce, and that is our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Excess and loosely secured weapons and munitions worldwide pose a security risk and humanitarian threat through illicit diversion to terrorists, insurgents, and other destabilizing actors. Landmines, unexploded ordnance, and other explosive remnants of war not only kill and maim thousands of people every year, they stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and reconstruction and inhibit long-term development. The United States is committed to making post-conflict communities safer, thus saving lives, pulls to return to their homes, which enables faster economic recovery and development. To highlight U.S. government efforts in this area, the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement issues a yearly report entitled To Walk the Earth in Safety. The most recent edition, released on December 12th, documents how the United States has invested more than $2.9 billion since 1993 for the securing and safe disposal of excess small arms, light weapons, and munitions, as well as the safe clearance of landmines and explosive remnants of war in more than 100 countries. This investment makes the United States the world's single largest financial supporter of conventional weapons destruction. Many of these programs not only clear landmines and unexploded ordnance, they also help to educate communities, especially children, on how to prevent injuries and death from landmines and explosive remnants of war, and create jobs that can provide a boost to post-conflict recovery efforts. Conventional weapons destruction is a complicated process that requires broad international cooperation. Therefore, the State Department, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other U.S. governments, non-governmental or mental organizations, and private companies to reduce conventional weapons and munitions stockpiles, improve security at storage sites, and implement humanitarian mine action programs. In her introduction to the report, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs, Tina Kaidenow, noted that support for conventional weapons destruction is a cornerstone of our national security policy, and stressed that the success of our program is built on strong bipartisan support from Congress and the people of the United States, who recognize that our nation benefits from helping to create a world in which all may walk the earth in safety.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.